podcast is supported by SEAT.
This is Keaton Henson. He's a musician.
And something he knows all too well about is the power music can have on our emotions.
Something that I'm always really fascinated by is that I think humour and sadness are kind of inextricable, creatively speaking. And I find that, like, really interesting and something that you learn. Like, I think sadness is innate, but you learn that tightrope as you start creating, and it's amazing how quickly you can lose an audience without humour. There's an amazing kind of emotional reaction which is unique and kind of really fascinating. And there's a performance of Loudon and Wainwright performing Motel Blues. It's a song about being an adult man and at your lowest ebb after a divorce, and he's trying to sleep with an 18-year-old girl in a club. And he's kind of talking about his career and, like, bigging himself up and talking about his next album. And it's a funny song. He sings this lyric, and he's an amazing performer in that he uses his face to sell a song. And he sings this line about, I'll write a song for you and put it on my next LP. And he kind of gurns when he sings LP, and he does it in a really kind of over-the-top, clownish way. I'll write a song for you. I'll put it on my next LP. Audience laughs, and the direct next line is, come back to my motel room and sleep with me. And it's like he hits you in the face with that, and there's a sound that happens. It's a laugh kind of being swallowed, like you're halfway through laughing and you swallow it with sadness. And to me, that's like it's one of the most powerful forms of emotional reaction to a song.
Welcome to another Brainwaves. I'm Natalie Nahai.
And I'm Kevin Fong. I'll put up a sign to warn the cleanup man. Yeah, there's lots of soap and there's lots of towels. Never mind them desk clerk scowls. I'll buy you breakfast.
So it'd be criminal to do a series about emotions without slipping some music in there.
Yes, and as Keaton alluded to there, music can make us experience a huge range of emotions. And as we'll find out in this episode, it has an intimate link to each and every one of us.
So where better to start than taking a look back throughout human history?
It's probably the most difficult question you could possibly ask.
This is Dr. Valerie Salimpour.
Well, that's a very interesting question. So we know that there's some evidence of music dating back 40,000 years. And that's pretty amazing, because this is prehistoric man that we're talking about. Some flutes or some things that look like flutes have been found in caves of Germany. And what's interesting is that if you think about the hunting and gathering lifestyle, and if you think about these men and women sitting in their caves and taking time out from hunting and gathering to carve out flutes out of vulture bones and mammoth bones to be able to produce sounds that they can hear for enjoyment, that's pretty amazing, because it suggests that there seems to be something unique to music that is central to humanity. As far as we know, music doesn't have any survival value, but these prehistoric men are sitting there taking time out of other acts of survival, or that are necessary for survival, to be able to produce something that makes them feel good.
So look, we've already heard in this series about entrainment and the power of rhythm seeking. So, you know, I guess it isn't that much of a surprise that music plays a part in history and features, you know, in ancient humanity. But, you know, with all the usual caveats about being able to theorise about what part this played in evolution, you can see how people might have some theories about a role it might play and how music might evolve alongside our own human evolution.
Yes, and as Valerie said, music doesn't seem to have any direct survival advantages. But there was a really wonderful quote that Darwin gave us, and he said that the human musical faculty must be ranked amongst the most mysterious with which he is endowed. So it's this idea that music seems to be this human cultural universal that doesn't seem to have a specific adaptive purpose, but it must serve some kind of function. So, for instance, there have been researchers that have found similarities between language and music, indicating that they maybe share an evolutionary history.
And it's not just humans that seem to use music.
No, I mean, it's a bit strange for us to think of it, I suppose, in this way. But in evolutionary biology, there's this idea of convergent evolution. So it's a process whereby organisms that aren't closely related, so it could be a human and a bird, will independently evolve similar traits by virtue of the fact that they've had to adapt to their environments or ecological niches. So, for instance, some researchers in the 90s found that vocal learning has evolved at least in three types of birds, songbirds, parrots and hummingbirds, that you don't necessarily find in all other kinds of birds. And it's that kind of singing that you also find in humans that you don't actually find in other primates that might use, you know, manual drumming instead, for instance.
And whilst we'll probably never know how and why music evolved, it does play a crucial role in our emotions.
One of the most fun things about going to festivals.
This is Dr. Jessica Grant.
Yeah.
She runs the Music and Neuroscience Lab at Western University, Ontario.
One of the most replicated in science functions of music, something that you can observe over and over again, is that music really helps people express and regulate their emotions. So it can be cathartic. You choose music to really wallow in whatever terrible feeling you're having at the moment, to really feel it to its deepest, which helps you sort of potentially process it and move on. Or you can use it as a distraction. You're feeling a bit low energy, a bit so-so, and then you pull on the right music for you. And suddenly your mood can be lifted and you have energy again. So one idea about why it is that music does tap into our emotions so deeply is that potentially, and these are all theories, just so stories, because we don't really have the data yet to say what actually happened, but one idea was that when music and language evolved, they sort of evolved together as a musa language, so that there were emotional expressions, you know, sighs, or other things that we recognize in as expressing an emotion in somebody. And then over time, the language component diverged off to really just carry what we call propositional information, you know, telling you how to do things, what to do things, communicating specific concrete facts or directions. And that the emotional side of things, although it's somewhat present in language, then started to become more specially produced or tapped into by music. And so that these things separated into two different things. You had language for sort of the practicalities of day to day, and then music really became about emotional expression. And so this is where you had all of your rituals really based around musical and dance events. These things were really bound together. But there were also things like funeral songs and these things, the expressions that people make, you know, there's often what we call keening or wailing as part of these mourning or grieving songs that really mimic the sorts of sounds that people would make if they're actually crying or grieving. And the music starts to capture that. And so there is an idea that even way back when, music quickly became specialized to convey the emotional aspects of what somebody was feeling.
So I quite like that idea, really, of music as a sort of an offshoot of language. I mean, language at its best is relatively unambiguous, and using music as a way of less ambiguous or unambiguous expression for things that really you can't put into words makes sense, at least at that level. So I used to work for a surgeon who, after a long and difficult and hair-raising operation, used to close the wound right at the end of the operation and insist that we played Elvis Presley's Glory, Glory, Hallelujah at top volume on the stereo in the operating theatre, which I'm not sure what he was trying to express there. But here again, we have that concept that we visited in an earlier episode of using something external to hack emotions to sort of create this unitary emotion in everybody at the same time, you know, in the same way that someone like Brendan Walker, who designs, thrill rides, It sort of hacks your fight and flight response to make everybody feel that spine tingling sensation. Musicians can also do the same, but with a much wider spectrum of emotion.
What's really interesting about music is that it allows you to experience a wide range of emotions.
Valerie Salimpour again.
And experience the emotional arousal that's associated with those emotions without actually experiencing any consequences. And that's really neat, because if you think about the everyday lives that people experience don't necessarily contain a lot of emotional arousal. I mean, you go to work and you come home and you eat dinner and you spend some time with your family. There aren't really that many emotional ups and downs, so you don't necessarily get that rush that you would get from intense emotional arousal unless something happens. And this could be obviously something positive, or it could be something negative. Now, if it's something negative, sometimes you might be sad because something bad has happened. Something has anteceded that, or you might be scared because something bad is about to happen. So music lets you experience these without any consequences. So you still get to feel these emotions, but then nothing bad has happened and nothing bad is going to happen. So you're just taken out of that context and you're allowed to experience these feelings of arousal that human beings find so pleasurable without the actual consequence. And that's one reason why people listen to sad music, and it makes them happy, because you think to yourself, well, why would you want to make yourself sad? If sad music was actually making you genuinely sad, then is that a good thing? Is that something you really want to experience? And that's a question that's still debated, and many argue that when you listen to sad music, you actually become happy. Or not necessarily happy, but it makes you feel good. And that's, again, because you're allowed to experience the incredible arousal that comes with feeling that emotion without something bad having happened in your life.
So it sounds like this has actually been shown experimentally, the fact that music can elicit a whole range of emotional states. But it's also something that I'm sure all of us can relate to on an anecdotal level. I remember once being on a coach ride, actually, to Birmingham of all places, and listening for the first time to one of Rachmaninoff's pieces. And there was this huge crescendo in the middle of the piece, and it was a really short piece. And it was so overwhelming that I just couldn't hold the feeling and the sound, and I just started crying. And it wasn't a sadness, it was just this, oh my God, it's so beautiful. And another piece that's called The Clown in opera that Pavarotti sang, same thing happening again. There's just so much pathos in the music and this sense of release. And it's something that we don't experience in the day-to-day, like Valerie says, riding this crest of emotion that doesn't mean that we're in danger, that doesn't mean that we're about to lose, you know, our loved ones, but that gives us a sensation of being alive.
It's interesting, isn't it? And I was getting a taxi to the airport the other day, and the cab driver, they were playing Stevie Wonder's Lately, which is, you know, a very sad breakup song. And he heard it and it was really interesting. He was musing about it. He said, yeah, I bought this as a single. I remember buying this and playing it over and over again. And it must have been a terrible year. I would never have bought a single like that usually. And then he had to think about it. And then he remembered somewhere why it was that he'd bought that single. And then he just said, yeah, it was a terrible year. And it was clearly some breakup, you know, some teenage relationship, some breakup. And so it definitely has, music definitely has the ability to trigger memories, but also clearly emotions. But what I really want to know is, how does music so specifically have this emotional trigger in the brain? How does it trigger our emotions?
One of the exciting things about being a neuroscientist who studies music is that you have lots of different brain areas to work with, because so much of the brain responds when people are listening to music.
Jessica Grahn again.
So you naturally get sensory processing areas, so auditory areas respond because you're listening to something. But you also tend to see a lot of movement-related areas responding, even when people are not actually doing any movements, they're just sitting there listening. You see memory-related areas, emotion processing areas. We know that a lot of these areas are communicating with each other at the time people are listening as well. So in addition to just being active, we can see that they're really interacting.
Valerie Salimpour went one step further and set up an experiment to look at this.
Well, we wanted to know why this is happening, why people are feeling such intense pleasure when they listen to music. So the way that we went about doing that is by asking people to bring in music into the laboratory that makes them feel intensely pleasurable. So to do this, we thought, let's find something that makes them very emotional. And we asked people to bring music that gives them chills or goosebumps. And this is a very good objective way of measuring the physiological responses that they're experiencing to music. And we hooked them up to psychophysiological equipment And this is sort of measuring the autonomic nervous system arousal of the brain. So this is the objective emotional arousal system. Because if you ask someone subjectively, how do you feel in response to this? Is this emotional? They might say yes, but then is that the same as somebody else's yes to how much emotion they're experiencing? So we had to find a way of measuring it more objectively, and we used the psychophysiological equipment. So this includes measures of heart rate, respiration, skin conductance, blood volume, pulse, etc. These are things that you can't really control. Once we measure these, as people are listening to music and they're telling us how much pleasure they're feeling, we find that as their pleasure increases, their emotional arousal is also increasing. And we thought, well, that's really interesting. Now, what's going on in the brain? What's actually converting this emotion to pleasure? And in order to examine that, we asked those same people to go inside a PET scanner, and this allows us to look at some of the neurochemicals in the brain that are being released when people listen to intensely pleasurable music or even experience intense emotions to music. So we hooked them up to the equipment and we watched what was going on in their brains, and we found something that was really neat, which is when they experience chills or those moments of intense pleasure, they actually release dopamine in the brain. They release dopamine in the mesolimbic regions of the brain. And this is big. This is really neat, because other things that do this are drugs like cocaine, amphetamines, and it's really neat because the system is actually very old. It's phylogenetically very old. It exists in other mammals as well. It's sort of a deep structure in the brain, the mesolimbic regions, and they've essentially evolved to reinforce highly adaptive behaviors. And these are things like eating and sex and things that are necessary for survival of our species.
It's fascinating work, that. You can't measure emotions, you know, even with the equipment that she's got. And that stuff with the heart rate and the breathing and the sweating that she says, you know, you can't control. Yeah, it's a poor surrogate. I mean, that's why lie detectors don't work. The more advanced stuff, the stuff with the imaging, positron emission tomography, you know, you're injecting radioactive substances, you're looking at the brain really close up. That's pretty fascinating and very reductionist. And even then, what you're looking at is the mechanisms in the brain that music is tweaking. But it is still, nevertheless, a fascinating finding that music reliably tweaks these dopaminergic pathways that are ancient in human evolution. And so it tells us a lot.
And I think what's particularly fascinating is that it only looks at one facet, and yet this one facet of emotion and the sensation of emotion can tell us some really interesting things. For instance, a whole bunch of localized electrical brain stimulation studies have found that the mesolimbic dopamine system is active not only in positive rewarding states, so when you're listening to a piece of music that makes you feel elated, but also in what psychologists call appetitive, motivated behaviours, so in seeking of something. And this can be even when you're experiencing aversive stimuli and stress. So the sense that if you're listening to something really exciting and uplifting, or something quite terrifying or sad, you still can notice a pattern of dopamine release in the brain. And it's this that I find so curious, that regardless of the kind of arousal, you're still getting this kind of rewarding behaviour getting kicked in.
And this is all really just about music from the point of view of the listener, but what about people who make music? Does music play a similar role for them in their emotions?
I haven't actually eaten lunch yet.
Back to Keaton Henson, a musician, composer and visual artist.
So yeah, I started writing when I was about 12, 13, but I wouldn't say I was kind of writing anything of great emotional worth until, I don't know, I was probably about 17, 18 when I started writing the songs for the first record. So yeah, I'd say that's probably the first. I think I started writing as a kind of purge, like as it was like purely personal, and I didn't want them to be, they weren't intended to be released. Like the idea was that they were entirely personal and like recorded and stashed under my bed. So yeah, it was actually an emotional reason to kind of like start actually writing autobiographical songs particularly. I don't know why I decided that they should be released, but once they've been released, then you're in that, and it's hard to go back. But yeah, it was to get rid of stuff, like to, yeah, it's such a cliche to say release, but like to like, I guess I started writing to rid myself of like that which I have an excess of. I think it's, if you have an excess of a particular feeling, you kind of have to level out. So, yeah. Absolutely no idea, and I think that's why it's like the most important thing to me, because I cannot rationalize it in any way. The amazing thing about when you start to do this stuff, and songwriting has always been something that I've kind of understood, but then I compose now, and the reason I was so enamored with classical music is because I didn't know how they did it, and then you start to learn how they do it. And that there is a kind of process, and then there's certain pieces, and you decode them. Like I'll spend a lot of time breaking them down to their component parts, and like literally mapping out what every instrument is playing, and looking through it. And I still have absolutely no idea why it makes me like crawl up into a ball. I just yeah, there's like a magic to it, which is rare, I think. Because I would consider myself to be a fairly logical person and want to know the reason behind things. And I'm just in love with the fact that I have no idea why we all do this. And why that chord makes people feel sad, or that chord following the preceding chord. But it's beautiful and like hugely frustrating, but I hope we never find out why, really.
So, creating music, you know, as well as listening, seems to have very real benefits for some people, and seems to be able to modulate our emotions. And one emotion that's always been linked to music is that of melancholia.
From the time of the classics, there has been a positive creative association with melancholy, which comes through Aristotle
This is Professor Clark Lawler from Northumbria University, Newcastle.
Who said in Problemata 30, which was one of these statements about diseases and conditions that he had. He said that, you know, men, he was talking about men primarily, so it became a gendered male tradition, of genius who achieve things in life, whether it be intellectual or you know, they're great statesmen or something like that. They all have this melancholic tinge to them. They can quite often suffer from melancholic diseases because it was thought that, you know, the four humours that people were supposed to have in those days, if they were in balance, you were fine. But if you had a predominance of the melancholy humour, the black bile, which is one of the humours, then it could tip over into disease. But it also gave you, through this effect on the brain, the potential, if it's not too severe, to aid your psychological processes and, in fact, make you sharper, more intelligent, more creative. You could be a genius. And this idea, this classical idea, has persisted for a tremendously long time throughout history, even to the point where, up to the present day, really, even though melancholia is now a kind of very small subcategory of the in the diagnostical and statistical manual, the association with depression is still that, you know, if there's not too much of it, it's associated with creative people. It's a mythology, obviously, partly, but that has been a very long classical and literary precedent that's fed up to the present day.
So is melancholia possibly a necessary evil?
Of course, all our modern efforts are bent towards eliminating what we now call depression, which one can roughly equate to more historical understandings of melancholy. But whether it's desirable to have melancholy is, as I say, is a matter of debate amongst various people. I mean, if you suffer from a severe form of melancholy, it was considered to be, from classical times onwards, tipping over into madness. you know, say you equated it roughly with a severe depressive episode today, that doesn't help creativity at all. That just kind of kills it off.
It's an interesting concept here. We're moving around between historical language and technical and non-technical language. You know, melancholy and the sort of natural variations in emotions from being happy and being sad, I think all of us understand, really, that we move between those poles. For some people, it's more extreme. Now, there is a difference between melancholy and depression. The medical definition of depression is really something where your mood is so low that it begins to interfere with your activities of daily living. And so he began to hint at it really at the end of that piece there about, well, that requirement for a certain amount of sadness to spur creativity and their intellectual pursuits, but not so much that it would paralyze them completely. So it is interesting. And that connection between melancholy and genius, depression and genius, is a very, very interesting thing to explore, but difficult to unpick.
I mean, it kind of plays into the hand of the tortured genius archetype that we have in modern times, but also our dislike of being in uncomfortable places of feeling. So for things like sadness or anger or rage or whatever it might be, that we feel the need to medicalize these emotions. And one thing that I think was beautifully written about depression and melancholia was a piece, it was actually a book written by Eric G. Wilson, and his book is called Against Happiness, In Praise of Melancholy, and it seeks to tease apart what these two labels might actually be hinting at. So depression, he says, causes apathy in the face of this unease, lethargy approaching total paralysis, and inability to feel much of anything one way or another. In contrast, Eric says that melancholia generates a deep feeling in regard to this same anxiety, a turbulence of heart that results in an active questioning of the status quo, a perpetual longing to create new ways of being and seeing. So it kind of looks at these two cousins, these relatives, depression and melancholia, and talks about one being much more apathetic and more passive, and the other being the thing that is required to create the tension through which creativity can emerge. And I think that an important part of experiencing one's melancholy fully comes with music. It's a tool that allows us to flex our emotional muscles, if you like. And because of this, it's become ingrained in our culture and in a way in our memories as well.
The privileged role that music plays in accessing memory is a really neat feature of music because you can think of this in two ways. There's sort of explicit memory and implicit memory. In terms of explicit memory, this is the memories that you're aware of and you can recall. If we ask you to recall a time in your life, maybe prom or time that you spent with an ex-partner, you might just be able to sort of verbally recall that and not feel too much. But then if you hear a piece of music that you associate with that person or with that time in your life, it's an entirely different story. You all of a sudden start to feel a rush of emotions that you might not even have had access to otherwise.
And similar to the Proust phenomenon that we spoke about in episode 2, this is part of our explicit memory system. And then you have...
So implicit memory is basically the memory that you don't necessarily have access to and are not aware of, in other words. And this memory is really interesting for my work because we're finding now that it essentially determines what music you like now. So let me put it this way. We're finding that all of the music that you've heard in the past gets encoded in auditory cortex, regions of the brain that store sound information. And it's believed that these regions store templates of all of the sounds based on all of the sounds that you've heard in the past. And these templates allow your brain to make some predictions about how music and sounds should be organized. And this is a really complex activity that your brain does. It involves the most complex and high-order regions of the brain that are, again, most evolved in humans. And what's neat is that this determines what music you like now. So the music that you may have heard as a child that you were exposed to in the past, or the music that you've associated with different emotions as a teenager, all of this will have a very significant, all of this is believed to have a very significant impact on the music that you like now, and that's all because of the way that your brain makes predictions.
I think that's fascinating. It reminds me of the snake eating its own tail. So the idea of you're fed music and then you listen to more music and that influences the music that you like. But also to the role and responsibility that your parents have in fostering a smart sense of what is proper music, i.e. the Beatles, etc.
Still doesn't explain why anyone likes jazz, though.
I like jazz. What are you talking
about? Actually, I do like jazz. But I think it's an interesting thing, isn't it, that there are such different tastes in music and that it can be organised along emotional lines like that, and that you file sounds, which are such a basic stimulus, really, sounds, and you couple them with memories, so memories of episodes, memories of emotions. It's funny that you should attach them so specifically, because you don't really attach words in the same way. Not really, not so specifically.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's the first thing. Sound is the first sense that we experience in gestation, in the womb. It's the mother's heartbeat, it's the drum, and the sounds that you hear while you're developing. And then when we're pre-verbal and in a synesthetic state, all of the senses are connected. So to me, it makes perfect sense that sound would be such a far-reaching, all-encompassing, integrated activity that generates extraordinary, well, activity in the brain, that it can reach all of these other hard-to-reach places.
So having very loosely looked at the science of emotion in the first four episodes, we've decided to reverse the gaze for our final and fifth episode and look at the role emotion plays in science.
Science of emotions and the emotions of science. I like it. This episode of Brainwaves was presented by me, Natalie Nahai, and Dr. Kevin Fong.
The producers were Eva Krisiak and Max Sanderson.
With original music by Jed Flood.
For more information about The Guardian's multi-platform exploration of emotion, head over to theguardian.com and search Brainwaves.
This podcast was supported by SEAT.